Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 208, In Search of the Perfect Sear. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast all about home cooking, getting in the kitchen, learning new things, having fun. On today's episode, my friend Christine Pittman from the Recipe of the Day podcast and Cook the Story blog stops by. She's going to share with us one of her favorite cooking techniques, the reverse sear. Of course, after talking with Christine, I went on a little bit of a chicken craving. So later in the show, I'm going to share a little bit about one of my favorite chicken preparation techniques. I've also got a short bit about one of my most favorite and underrated kitchen tools. And Liz Williams from the Southern Food and Beverage Museum will be back for a short book review segment, her Meat and Three, in the middle of the show. So stick around for all of that. That'll be up in a few minutes. Of course, before we get there, we do have a couple of bits of housekeeping, as usual. Most importantly, remember that the show notes for this episode will be over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/208. Again, that's kitchencounterpodcast.com/208. There you will find all sorts of links to things that are discussed in this episode, including how to find Christine, her podcast and her blog, and a couple of her recipes, and a bunch of other stuff. So head over there for all of that goodness after you listen to the episode. Incidentally, in all of my show notes and on my website for that matter are links to all of my social media. So if you want to connect with me on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, head over there. You can find all of the links, including to the private Facebook group, The Kitchen Counter Coffee Break. If you don't feel like going to the show notes, just head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/group to get there. Also, if you'd like to send me an email, you can do so over to feedback@kitchencounterpodcast.com. And don't forget, The Kitchen Counter Podcast is a member of Nitty Grits Podcast, which is a network out of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, Louisiana. To find my show there and a bunch of other great stuff, other wonderful shows, head over to southernfood.org. And finally, if you like what I do here at the show and you want to support the show, there's actually a lot of ways you can do it and you don't have to spend a penny. One is just to tell your friends and family about the show, or you could head over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the podcast and leave a rating and review if the app allows you to do that. You could also shop on Amazon.com through my affiliate link for my website. And sometimes I put links in the show notes to products. I'll have probably a couple in there today. It doesn't cost you anything more from Amazon, and I get a few cents kickback if you buy something. And also, you could buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TKC podcast. Several of you have bought me coffees, and I appreciate each and every one of you. Joan, Chris, JM, Ashley, some that don't have names associated with them, but you know who you are. I appreciate you very, very much. So it just helps keep the lights on, so to speak, takes care of some of the operational stuff for the podcast. So thank you very much. All right, let's get into this. First up today, as I mentioned, Christine Pittman from Recipe of the Day, Cook the Story blog, and a bunch of other cool stuff that she'll mention when we talk to her. Christine stopped by the show and we had a conversation about reverse sear as a cooking technique. I'll be honest with you, I wasn't sure exactly what I was going to learn because I was pretty certain I was familiar with reverse searing. And I mean, I know what it is and I've used it, but Christine really opened my eyes to some other ways I could use reverse searing, coupling it with cooking methods I really wouldn't have thought of before. So had a great conversation, a lot of fun with Christine. So let's hop over to that conversation and talk about the reverse sear. All All right. Well, Christine, thanks for being on the show. I'm excited to talk to you today about reverse searing.
Thanks for having me. It's one of my favorite topics. So yeah, let's do it.
It's one of your favorite topics?
Yeah.
I love it. You know, I have to admit, I do a little reverse searing, but not a lot. And it'll come up when we talk, I think. There's one cooking technique that I would tend to use with reverse searing, but I don't want to blurt it out now. Okay. We'll get to that in a minute. And actually, I'm going to ask you a little more detail about this later, but you have a couple of great blogs, mm-hmm. and you have a great podcast called Recipe of the Day, which you somehow manage to turn out every day a podcast about a particular recipe.
Every single day. I kicked myself. What was I thinking? But it is fun doing, you know, you smile when you're talking and recording yourself, and then I'm happy after recording. So every day is pretty fun.
Let's jump into reverse sear. We're getting into the time of year where people are either going to be getting outside to cook more meat or maybe even just cooking more meat inside. And this concept of reverse sear, I think it's kind of a, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe kind of a recent thing that people are really embracing. I mean, it's been around for a while, but I hear a lot about it.
Yeah, I think it's been around. So the first reverse sear thing that I did on my site was probably 8 years ago. And it was inspired by Kenji on Serious Eats had a prime rib, and he was testing all the different ways, and he did this reverse sear prime rib. And I had been researching the best way to roast pork. And I was like, wait a minute, this is brilliant. You get that nice crunchy outside and juicy inside, which is exactly what you want from like a pork shoulder or pork butt. I am trying this. So that was then. I think that happened. And then the popularity has sort of spooled out from there. That's the most popular recipe on my site, the reverse sear pork. Like hundreds of thousands of millions of people, I think probably a year come to that one. So it is a technique that is beloved by many now.
So what is a reverse sear? I mean, what's the definition, the textbook definition?
Yeah, so I think it's like, why are we calling it reverse? And I think it's because it's the opposite of what many of us learned when we were first learning to cook. So when I was first learning to cook, if I was doing any kind of roast, especially, you sear it in first, and it was said to like seal in the juices or something along those lines. So you sear at the beginning and then you do your slow cooking after. And so the reverse sear is the reverse of that. You do your slow cooking first, and then for almost all of the cuts of meat, you let it rest fully. It does that full 30, 45 minute rest, depending on the size of the roast. If it's a steak or something, it would be a less amount of time, but that lets all those juices settle in, right? And so that when you cut into it, it's not going to just like juice everywhere. So your juices are nice and contained now. Then you put it in extreme heat, like 500 degrees Fahrenheit in your oven. And that crisps up the outside, and it's only in there for a few minutes, depending on the cut or whatever, but like a roast 10, 15 minutes until it's nice and brown on the outside. So you're getting all that beautiful caramelization, crispy fat, crispy skin, all that sort of stuff going on, but it's still crispy at the end, right? So you're mm-hmm. searing mm-hmm. at the end instead of the beginning. And there's lots of benefits of doing that.
So I always think my first go-to like cut or type of meat when I think of a reverse sear is a steak.
Mm-hmm.
But what so steak is an obvious one. You mentioned roast, which I don't mm-hmm. think I would do a reverse sear on like intuitively, but that's a great
right.
idea. What other, I mean, can we do this with chicken? Can we do it?
Yes.
What can we do a reverse sear with?
Okay. So I'm going to back up a little bit because I think it really makes so much sense if you understand this part.
Okay.
One of the most beautiful things about this is, of course, that nice crunchy outside that you get. I've already said that. The other beautiful thing that you get is that rest time that is guaranteed right at the end there. So, and you can do it longer, like at 45 minute rest time, hour rest time, because you're going back into the oven for that little while. Something that cools off on the outside is going to get that reheated sort of thing happen, right? That means that you can get all your other things ready. It means you know your roast is fully cooked by a certain time. All of that is great, right? So that leads me to one of my favorite things to reverse sear is chicken pieces, drumsticks, chicken thighs, bone in, especially if I'm having a big gang over for some kind of barbecue or something, because I can do that slow cooking even the day before. Big pan of chicken pieces in the oven at 300, 275 even, until they're fully cooked, juicy and amazing. Then I can let them cool. I can add sauce. I can do any of that kind of thing in the fridge or on the counter for a little while. And then when I want to serve them, it's like a couple of minutes. I can stick them on the grill. You're going to get all that beautiful grilled caramelization on the outside. If you have sauce, it's going to caramelize. You're doing all that nice crunchy stuff, but you know your food is fully cooked. When you know you have a barbecue, all the people running around and you're like, oh no, is that chicken cooked? It's done. You know it's done. So you're getting the best flavor, juicy, slow cooked chicken meat with crispy, crunchy outside. And you know for sure it's going to work. You're not worried about it. It's just beautiful. So yes, chicken, absolutely. Ribs are, I do ribs the same way. Slow cooked in the oven. I guess you could slow cook them on the grill wrapped in foil, like that kind of technique. And then a little bit of sauce.
Anywhere you could control the temperature, right? I mean, you could, you could use,
Yeah, yeah. Sous vide is, of course, another, like, it's sort of very, like, you know, you do something in the sous vide and then you heat it in some way seared. I mean, I guess sear is sort of loosely, not necessarily in a pan, but in a pan, on a grill, under the broiler, a big hot oven. So any of those things, the ribs I do low and slow in the oven, like 2 hours in there at a low oven. And then I sauce them, cool them, and then they hit the grill. People can never believe it. They're just always like, how did you do this? And it's, yeah, it's very, very simple.
I 100% love the chicken idea because I think one of the biggest mistakes, especially when they're grilling chicken, is they cook chicken way too hot and way too fast. And it's like, I got to get this chicken cooked. And I don't know if that's because they want to make sure it's done or to your point, it's like, I got a crowd of hungry people. I need to crank up the heat. But you end up with like burnt chicken. And a little char is okay. But like, I don't want a chicken that's black all the way around. You know, that's no good. So I love this idea of cooking it perfectly to whatever temperature, letting it rest. And then again, with the reverse sear, you need like extreme heat for a very short amount of time just to crisp it up. You're not actually cooking anything with a sear, right? You're just adding color and flavor.
Yeah, just color and flavor and like a little bit of heat. So like I said, if you're going to put your chicken or your ribs in the fridge after you've done that first slow cook, you can overnight in the fridge. Then, you know, bring them to room temperature on the counter, 20, 30 minutes, and then they're hitting the grill. You are reheating them, but that it's such high heat and it just needs to penetrate that little bit. Those are small pieces. You couldn't do that with a roast, of course, in the fridge overnight and then high
heat. Yeah, that will not reheat. Sure.
Yeah, I know.
Sure.
No, that wouldn't work. But the other thing that's super important, you're saying people, they overcook chicken on the grill and it's because they want the inside to reach that temperature. And for that inside, chicken breast, chicken thighs, any of that, to get there, the outside is in that direct heat for way too long and it's drying out. So we're making sure that the chicken is fully cooked at a nice, gentle rate so that all of the chicken is kind of more evenly and gently cooked. And then we're adding that delicious grill flavor at the end.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I'm going to try that next time I make chicken. I've never reverse seared chicken with one exception. And I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, there's like one technique that I typically use when I think of reverse sear. And you mentioned it too, which is sous vide.
Right.
So I think the first thing I think of is like a steak, sous vide, cooked to whatever perfect temperature you want. So it's even all the way through. And then like on a cast iron pan, hot, and give it that crust, right? I do that with chicken breast too, for example, like boneless, skinless chicken breast, which I have to say, sous vide is like one of the only ways you can make those palatable. That's not true, but it takes like it's, you know what I mean? It's like foolproof almost.
Yeah, it does. Brining chicken breast or sous vide chicken breast.
That's right.
And I don't really want to, you know, get mad at restaurants all over the world or anything, but I sometimes, you know, I order a chicken breast in a restaurant sometimes and I'm just like, there's no excuse for this dry chicken breast anymore. We have all these techniques that we know about to make a nice juicy chicken breast. Everybody should have it, but
yeah, you're suffering through like a chalky. I get it. So I mentioned sous vide, you mentioned baking in the oven. I mean, is there any cooking method that you couldn't pair up with a reverse sear? I mean, it seems like as long as you can control the time and the temp, you can do it.
I think that's it. I feel like it would be weird to like poach something like a chicken breast. And then but I feel like that's more just because if I'm poaching a chicken breast, I want it for a certain kind of purpose, like a chicken salad or something where I then don't want the grill marks. So I'm sure it would work. It just doesn't intuitively make sense to me that I would do that. But yeah, anytime you can control the temperature and you get it nice and low and slow and then blast it at the end, it's perfect.
And, you know, I guess braising probably doesn't really work either because the end product is too moist. And I don't know. Or does it work?
Oh, I'm going to tell you my short ribs recipe at Instant Pot short ribs. So it's not exactly low and slow first, but I've done it that way too. So low and slow short ribs or Instant Pot pressure cook short ribs. And then you don't really have to let them rest because they've been, you know, slow cooked for a long time. That's not the same thing. Sure. But then a little bit of oil on them and in the air fryer, under the broiler or in a hot pan or sous vide, right? You do a sous vide short rib. But yeah, braised in that little bit of liquid and then blot them off. And then you get that same, the best short ribs. Like, I'm not even kidding. They're just so like crust on the outside and that delicious like fall apart beef meat inside. So
good. I am definitely of the brown them before slow cooking camp. So I'm going to have to try this.
Yeah, no, I don't brown them before. Toss them straight. I don't do the slow cook, but I toss them straight into the Instant Pot on like a trivet with a little bit of beef broth or beef stock underneath. So salt and pepper, lid on. I think it's like 30 minutes in the Instant Pot. And then they go in the air fryer under the broiler after, depending on how many I have.
Wow, you're opening up my eyes. I thought, what could there, how deep can we go into reverse sear? My gosh, there's all sorts of stuff.
Well, I think it makes sense if we, and I'm revisiting that article from Serious Eats a little bit in my mind and in my memory, but the basic idea was the reason that we sear at the beginning was, is to add that caramelization flavor. And it used to be thought to sear in the juices, but I think it's been disproven that we're not searing in juices. So all we're trying to do is get that flavor. Does it matter when we get the flavor? Now, if we get the flavor and an amazing texture at the same time, then that's what we should be doing. So when you sear something like short ribs first and then braise them for a long time, you do have that nice caramelization flavor, but the crunchiness is gone. It gets steamed off in the liquid.
That's true.
We're still getting the flavor, but we're trying to retain that texture at the same time by doing it at the end.
So we've kind of established what a reverse sear is, what kind of meat, which practically any really, depending on how you cook it, cooking methods. Is there any way you can screw up a reverse sear? Are there mistakes that new reverse searers need to watch out for?
It's pretty basic, and I don't exactly think so. I would say that you do want to make sure things rest well. So for the steak, it's not as important, but for the other roasts and things, because we're trying to retain that nice crunchy texture, which means that we want to eat the meat as soon as it comes off the heat, as soon as possible, right? So there's not a chance for the steam that's coming out of it to sort of start dissolving that. Right. So you really want to rest it first. So it's fully rested first. Then we're just really heating the outside. Maybe it's penetrating a little bit, but it's not disturbing all those juices and making them all bubbly and crazy. Right. And then you want to serve it immediately. So I think resting it fully before, trusting that it's going to still be hot. If we're talking about something big like a roast, I think there's this like, but I can't leave it on the counter for 30 minutes. It won't be, you know what I mean? That's fine. And then I think watching it, you know, all ovens, all broilers are not created equal. So like my recipes will say, put it back in 500 degree oven for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, whatever it says. And I don't know if you have an oven thermometer. I don't know how accurate your temperature is. It could be off, and you are at such a high heat that you could be burning things. So you do want to, you know, keep your eye on it and know that yours might be different than somebody else's, and just, you don't want to burn. You're doing really high heat there. That's probably the main things.
That's amazing. The chicken thing. I want to go get some chicken so I can try it this afternoon. Honestly, that's so smart.
Let me roast chicken too. Okay. So you can do, I've read for years that the best way to do a roast chicken for juiciness is breast side down, so that all that, the juices in the back and the dark meat drip down into the breast. And then you would flip it breast side up. But in my experience, if you do first half breast side down, second half breast side up, there's not enough time in the oven for the skin to crisp up really good, because the breast is kind of protected for that half a time, right? Mm-hmm. If you do the reverse sear, you do low chicken, breast side down first, then right side up for a little while, and then take it out, rest it, blast it under that heat. You're crisping up the skin.
Under the broiler in this case.
Under the broiler, or even like 500 degree oven is going to do it too. And you're going to brown that skin and that meat. The breast meat was protected from being on the bottom for a long time and got all those juices dripping into it. So you're getting juicier, slow cooked roast chicken with crispy skin.
All right. You're converting me to a chicken reverse searer.
Yeah. I love converts. That's great.
You know what else I love, Christine, is you're so passionate about it.
I told you, it's one of my favorite. You know, I love these things. You know, you're a cook, I'm a cook. When we've been taught something a certain way and have been doing it all the time, and then somebody blows our mind with, wait a minute, what if you spin it on its head? What if the reason you've been doing this was wrong all along? What if there's like a better way? And if you know you're cooking, you're just suddenly like, Like the world just opens up, right?
And in this particular technique, it's, you know, you do see a lot of techniques on the internet where you're like, that seems like a lot more work than it's worth. This is really not any more work. You're just doing it in a different order.
Yeah. I actually find it, I find it easier because like, if you're going to sear something first, like you're talking about like short ribs or something, you're going to sear first. You're not searing those in the silk cooker in the Instant Pot, right? You're, well, maybe the Instant Pot you could, but you're usually getting another pan. You're dealing with raw meat, like all of that. Here, it's fully cooked and you can keep it in the same roasting pan and stick it under there. Like it, it, you know, it, it's easier. Yeah, it's easier.
Well, thank you for coming and dropping some reverse sear knowledge bombs on us. Christine, I know you have a couple of great blogs. What are those blogs and where can we find them? We've already talked about your podcast, which I'll link to. And then maybe if you have any great social media you want to share, hit us.
Yeah. So the blogs are cookthestory.com. That one is my personal recipe blog that I started in 2010. So it's been around for a while. And then The Cookful is contributor based. We have a different guest chef or cookbook author on every month, and we dive into a topic. We just had Irvin Lin from Eat the Love on doing quick breads. Everybody loves Irvin. So, but yeah, so that's the contributor based one. And then my podcasts are Recipe of the Day and Time Management Insider. And I'm Cook the Story everywhere. So social media, Cook the Story is the best place to find me.
Awesome. And like I said, I'll put all of your links in the show notes so people can just head over there and find everything in one spot. Christine, thank you very much. I'm going to send you an email after I do the chicken. I'm going to let you know how it turned out. Oh, and then you can, we can revel in the glory of me learning a new technique.
I can't wait. Thanks for having me. This has been fun.
See, I told you, you were going to learn something about reverse searing. I learned stuff about it. Again, I thought it was a fairly straightforward topic, but like with anything home cooking related, there are just so many angles and levels to practically everything you can possibly do. Nothing is cut and dry. Nothing is right or wrong. Nothing is black or white. And this conversation with Christine just reinforces that for me. So Christine, thank you so much for stopping by. It was a lot of fun, and you're welcome back on the show anytime. Again, the show notes where I will have Christine's links and to her recipes as well will be over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/208. All right, let's take a quick break. I'm going to have Liz Williams pop on and deliver one of her meat and three book reviews. She sends these to me. You know, they're also syndicated on PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. But one caught my eye, and I was so pleased that she did a segment on this. I just had to share it. It's one of my favorite books in general of all time. But when it comes to the topic of food, or in this case, beverages, it's an absolute must read. If you like history, learning interesting facts and weird connections about things that you encounter every day, you really, really want to check this book out. So Liz, take it away.
Have a seat at our table for SOFAB's Meat in Three, a tasty meal for your reading pleasure, where we devour a culinary book and explore three delicious sides. Today's meat is A History of the World in Six Glasses by Tom Standage. It tells the story of the evolution of civilization through six different beverages, and it does so in an engaging style that is full of surprising connections. It is astonishingly wide in its outlook, its historical depth, and its goals. So here are the sides. First, this book is full of solid research and an imaginative, clever look at beer, wine, spirits, coffee, tea, and Coca-Cola. You're already hooked, right? Second, this book goes from the local to the global with logic and with verve. And third, after reading this ambitious attempt to connect and see the world through the bottom of a glass, you will be convinced that we are truly constantly weaving ourselves together by our shared need to hydrate in ever-differing ways. And you will be wondering what will fill the next glass you raise. I hope that you've enjoyed today's Meat in Three. brought to you by the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans. A Nitty Grits production. Come by and see us in New Orleans or visit us on the web at southernfood.org. This is Liz Williams for Meat in 3.
I'm serious, folks. If you have not read A History of the World in Six Glasses, you have to read it. It's phenomenal. And if you have read it, I'd love to hear what you thought about it. All right. I'm going to talk about one of my favorite cooking or preparation techniques, I guess is a better way to put it, for chicken. I mentioned in the intro that conversation with Christine, we actually spent a little bit of time talking about reverse sear and how it relates to chicken. And I thought, well, I just need to get some chicken and cook some chicken. I was craving it almost. So that's what I did. But before I get there, can we just talk for like 2 minutes about one of the most underrated but versatile and useful kitchen tools that you can find anywhere? It occurred to me, I've never talked about this, and I'm making it sound like a much bigger deal than it really is. I've never talked about it, but I use it every day, at least once, usually multiple times a day, for a variety of tasks. And I've always said, if you're stocking your kitchen, or you're starting out, or you're looking to get the best gear for home cooking, you should always start with a good knife. And I still stand by that, because a knife will, you know, you're going to use it every day when you're cooking. You're going to be using it to prep or whatever. Most of the things you do in the kitchen will involve a knife at some point. But this other item I realize I use all the time, and I just enjoy using it so much. It sounds so cornball, but I'm talking about my kitchen shears or kitchen scissors, whatever you want to call them. And the reason I'm bringing them up now is because they play a part in the next segment when I talk about chicken. But I recently picked up a new set of kitchen shears. I used to have this really cool set that had like the inside the handle, it had like the teeth that you could use to like crack open nuts and things like that. And it was really heavy duty. And over the years, I don't know, something happened to it and I lost it or it broke. I don't remember. I don't know where it went, but I ended up with this KitchenAid set, and they were fine. They were kind of just like straight scissors, but just heavy duty for kitchen work. And I just missed my other pair. So I snooped around and I finally landed on a pair of Messermeister 8-inch kitchen scissors. I think I got it on Amazon for like $12 to $15. It wasn't a lot of money. But I love these kitchen shears because not only do they have the little nutcracker insert inside the handles that my old kitchen shears had, it's got like more. And I know I'm waxing poetic and gushing a little bit about my kitchen shears, but honestly, if you don't have a pair, you just stop. You just need to get a pair, okay? And if you do have a pair, you probably use it like I do. I mean, look, let's say you buy a new meat thermometer, right? And it comes in like a plastic blister pack and you grab it. Like, what are you going to do? Take your good kitchen knife and hack into the blister pack to get that thing out of there? No, you're going to reach for your kitchen scissors. You're going to like make quick work of that blister pack and get that thermometer or whatever it is out of there, right? So that's just one thing I use it for. Cutting packages, opening bags, cutting string, whatever it is, I use it for that. But there's tons of other things, practical things that you can do with your kitchen shears, okay? Just on the cutting front, I've already talked about non-food items, but food items, they're great for cutting and trimming herbs. You ever buy a can of whole stewed tomatoes and you don't want to use the whole tomatoes, but you don't want to like pour them out on a cutting board and cut them up with your knife, and you don't want to drop them in a food processor because you don't want to turn them into tomato sauce. Just open the can, stick the sharp end of your scissors in there and snip, 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 snip until you cut those tomatoes up into whatever size you want. Tomatoes, tomatillos, I mean, whatever. It's no mess, super easy. If you like to prepare whole fish, if you fish or you just like to cook whole fish, kitchen scissors make trimming up and cleaning a fish a snap, cutting off the fins, getting into the fish a lot easier with a pair of kitchen shears. Breaking down poultry, absolutely essential for that. That's what I'm going to talk about in a minute, especially with the technique that I'm going to be focusing on. You can even buy dedicated poultry shears if it's something you do a lot. But if you're just doing it once in a while, just a good sturdy pair of kitchen scissors will do the trick. So lots of things you can cut in the kitchen with your scissors. But the pair I have, the Messermeisters, they've got a nutcracker, which also doubles as like a crab leg seafood cracker. It's got a built-in bottle opener. It's on the handle end. They have like what looks like flathead screwdriver tips, but you can use that to pry open, pop open, whatever. It's really a multi-functional tool, and I'm loving using it. I know it sounds dumb. I'm going off on kitchen shears, but I'll put a link to these in the show notes if you're interested in checking them out. But I bet you, if you have kitchen scissors, I bet you use them a lot more than you even think. All right, let's get on to the chicken topic. So what I want to talk about today is a technique called spatchcocking your chicken. You may have heard of it. It's a crazy sounding term. It essentially means splitting your chicken open and opening it up, laying it flat, and proceeding to cook it like that instead of a whole chicken where it's sort of round and it's got the cavity in the middle. When you spatchcock a chicken, you remove the backbone, flatten it out, and cook it. Now, look, I don't know where the term spatchcock comes from really, but you know, I Googled it and I got the 60 articles with the same copy and pasted definition or origin story or whatever. According to those sources, spatchcock is an old Irish term that essentially means dispatching the cock, meaning taking care of that chicken, right, or the rooster. So then I thought, well, I guess I'll just go grab my deluxe Food Lover's Companion book. I'm sure it's got an entry for it in there, and let's see what it says. So I just opened it up to the page, and here's what it says, spatchcock, verb. An older cooking term that's recently come back into vogue and describes splitting a small bird down the back, then opening out and flattening the two sides like a book. It's similar to the term butterfly, though spatchcock refers only to fowl, whereas butterflying typically applies to boneless cuts, meats, poultry, fish, and so on. And then you could also use it as a noun, which would be a bird that's split and spread in preparation for roasting or broiling. Or I would add grilling. So Christine and I talked a little bit about roasting a whole chicken and using a reverse sear technique on it in the first segment. You can definitely use a reverse sear technique with a spatchcock chicken as well. You don't have to, but you could. And in past episodes, I've even talked about roasting whole chickens. So what's the point of a spatchcock? Why even mess around with it? I mean, it already sounds like more work than just throwing a whole bird in the oven or whatever, right? So let me start with a couple of reasons why you might want to spatchcock a chicken, and then I'll talk a little bit about how you actually go about doing it. So the first reason, and I wouldn't say it's the most important reason, but it could be a consideration, is that a bird that you've spatchcocked and opened up will cook faster, or it can cook faster, than a whole bird, and oftentimes it'll cook more evenly. So look, a 5-pound bird in a 400-degree Fahrenheit oven that's a whole chicken, you're roasting it whole, that's probably going to take you an hour and 15 minutes, an hour and a half, could be a little more, could be a little less, but that's about the ballpark of time you're looking at. Well, when you spatchcock a chicken and you open it up and lay it flat, you can do a couple of things. You can crank up the heat, so you could go like up to 450, and the higher heat coupled with the more even layout of the chicken is going to cause it to cook a little faster. You can roast the same bird in, you know, 45 minutes or an hour. So you can save time and you can get a little more of an even cook on the bird. A couple of other reasons that I even prefer that I think personally are even more important. One, you expose all of the skin evenly. So you get a much crispier skin. Again, whether you're doing a reverse sear or not. Remember in our conversation, Christine and I, we talked about it, and she sort of talked about flipping the bird over and things like that. Well, with the spatchcock, you don't really have to fuss with that. You can open it up. All the skin is exposed on the upside of the bird, and you don't have to flip it or anything like that. And the skin will just get more crispy. You know, sometimes when you roast a whole chicken, the bottom part of the chicken, like where the bottom part of the thighs and stuff are, kind of gets wet and soggy, doesn't get crispy. Spatchcocking solves that problem. Not only that, you have much more surface area for your seasonings, for your rubs, whatever you want to do when you open up a bird by spatchcocking it. Plus, finally, it looks cool. I should mention, I'm talking about chickens, but you can also spatchcock game hens, small turkeys, or large turkeys, I suppose, for that matter, and probably even ducks, although I've never done that. The same principles would apply. So how do you spatchcock a chicken? Well, remember when I was gushing on and on about the kitchen shears? Ideally, you'll have a good set of those because that will make your job a lot easier. You can spatchcock with a knife, totally doable, especially if you have a good heavy-duty knife or maybe even like a cleaver. I just think scissors are easier, safer, and it's so much quicker, especially for a home cook when you're maybe only doing this occasionally and you're not practiced using a knife to spatchcock a bird. So I mentioned it's about removing the backbone so you can open the bird up. So what you're going to do with your whole chicken, first of all, if there's giblets or anything else inside the cavity, go ahead and take all of that out. Flip the bird over so it's breast side down and you're looking at the backbone. And you know, at the bottom of the cavity, at the base of the backbone, chickens will have that little round, basically their tail, that little lump of fatty flesh. It's like their tail, right? What you're going to want to do is take your kitchen shears and you're going to go to, you can start on the right or the left side, doesn't matter, but you're going to go to one side of that tail and you're essentially going to snip through the back of the chicken up one side of the backbone until you get to the top of the bird and cut clear through. And then you're going to repeat for the other side. And then what you'll end up with is, I don't know, an inch and a half or maybe a 2-inch wide strip of backbone. And then set that aside and save that. That's great for stock. Put that in your freezer bag. So when you have a batch of those or whatever, you can make some great chicken stock. But then what you do is you essentially turn the chicken over. The opening that you've cut out is now at the bottom. And you use your hands and you spread it out and lay it flat. So the legs and the thighs kind of pivot up and the breasts go flat. And then what you want to do, and this will sound a little weird if you've never done this, but you kind of want to give the chicken a little bit of CPR. You need to put the palm of your hands, make sure the chicken's on a surface that's not going to slide around like a heavy butcher block or whatever. And you just want to apply a good amount of pressure between the breasts of the chicken until you can kind of hear the sternum or the keel bone in there crack. And that'll help it lay a little bit flatter. If you don't quite get it, that's okay. But if you can get it to crack and lay even more flat, you'll be in better shape. And that's it. You've spatchcocked a chicken. Super easy. Season it as you will. And this is a great method for roasting, broiling, braising and stewing, and especially grilling when a whole chicken can be a little bit tricky to pull off. It really cooks a lot more evenly on a grill this way. Now, I know it's probably hard to visualize what I just explained if you've never seen it done before, if you've never tried it yourself. So I will find an example to put in the show notes of how to spatchcock a chicken so you can see it for yourself. And last but not least, and I should have mentioned this earlier on the show since we're kind of taking a meat-centric episode focus today. The best way to know when your chicken is done, whether or not you spatchcock it or you cook it whole or you're cooking parts or whatever, is to use a meat thermometer. If you plan on cooking any amount of chicken or meat or pork, whatever, a meat thermometer is essential, not only for food safety purposes, but for quality purposes too. I mean, you can cook a chicken way past 165 degrees Fahrenheit, which is what is considered the safe temperature for consuming chicken. But if you go too far past, you might have like terribly dry, chalky, rubbery chicken breasts, right? So you want a digital meat thermometer, preferably digital, so you can check the temperature as you're cooking it, so you can hit it right when it needs to come off of the heat. The whole method of, you know, looking in the joint and is the joint loose between the leg and the thigh or do the juices run clear when it's pierced? I mean, those aren't really reliable methods for knowing what temperature your chicken or your other meat's at. And really a thermometer is the way to go. So if you don't already have one and you're doing cooking at home and it involves meat, chicken, whatever, you definitely want to get yourself a meat thermometer. All right, that's my digital meat thermometer soapbox for the day. Yeah, so there you go, spatchcocking a chicken. If you cook chicken, it's definitely a technique you should try at least once to see how it works out for you. All right, everybody, that's going to do it for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Christine, thanks again for coming on the show. Really, really appreciate your time and your tips on the reverse sear. Show notes over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/208, where I'll have links to all of Christine's stuff, as well as the History of the World in Six Glasses book, kitchen shears, meat thermometers, a video on how to spatchcock a chicken, all that stuff will be there. Hey, I've got one more episode coming out within the week, probably. And if you're an olive lover, you definitely want to tune into this because my friend Seth Heasley stops in the show and we give a call to a fellow down in California, Don Landis, who is a bona fide olive expert. I mean, he grows them and processes his own olives. And we get the total lowdown on everything olive. So if that's your jam, you're not going to want to miss the next episode. After that, I'll probably take a couple of weeks off because I'm going to be doing a little bit of traveling. Don't worry if I find anything interesting, I'll share it with all of you. But yeah, that's what's coming up in the near future for the Kitchen Counter Podcast. So keep your eyes open for that. Don't forget to check out the Nitty Grits podcast over at southernfood.org. And don't forget to tell your friends, your family, your coworkers, complete strangers at the bus stop, whatever, about the show if you think they might get a little bit of value out of it. And don't forget to show them, if they don't know how to find a podcast, how you find the podcast and open up an entirely new crazy world for them. They'll only thank you for it. All right, everybody, until next time, I hope you get in the kitchen, cook something up for yourself, for the people you love, and have a great time doing it. I'm Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.